Nice to be back. I was sorry to miss seeing you last week. I really had a neat week, though. I was at Samish Island Campground, which many of us know well because we have an annual retreat there with the Zen community, and Norman Fisher, our guiding teacher, comes. Anyway, I rented it with some colleagues to have a mindfulness retreat. So, kind of like a Zen Sesshin, we got up at 5, we got 15 minutes later or something. We got up at 5:45, you know, and sitting and walking, a little bit of yoga, and some of the other practices from the mindfulness-based stress reduction world. And I gave a daily talk, and we had interviews, and so it was a lot like a Sesshin, really. We didn't do any bowing or chanting. And the one bit of chanting that I really was having trouble letting go of when I was thinking about this retreat, you know, because we're trying to make it accessible for people who don't want to, you know, be sort of like subjected to Buddhism or anything like that, who want it to be a little more universal. But the one piece of chanting I really couldn't quite let go of was that we do a lovely little chant in the evening. We'll do that here tonight if I can manage to end on time. A chant of repentance, a chant about of taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and it's sung melodically. It's really beautiful, and it's just such a beautiful moment at our Sesshin, maybe it's partly out of relief because we've been sitting there for 14 hours or something like that, to do this beautiful chant as we just close the day. And so I figured out an alternative. We read a poem together instead, and it worked just about as well. And so I thought I'd share with you the poem that we read. And setting the scene a little more, the participants came from all over the country for this. I got it advertised by one of the main mindfulness centers. And there were people from Florida and Colorado and Idaho, Chicago, all over the place. And most of them, I don't know about most of them, but about half of them, I think, had never done a week-long retreat before. So they're all very new to this. It made me think a little bit about how they talk about in Zen Beginner's Mind, in the introduction to Zen Beginner's Mind, that Suzuki Roshi was particularly excited about being in America because everyone was like new to it, you know, and didn't have any patterns or habits about it. So I thought, oh, this is a little bit like that, you know. These people are all new to this, seeing with fresh eyes, and I was a little worried, would they be completely exhausted by it, you know. But they did fine, they had good retreat, and in the end it had a very similar feeling, to me anyway, to our Zen retreats. And I was grateful the whole time for having been there so many times to do Zen retreats and kind of having this way of practice in my bones. I was feeling grateful to Norman and the Sangha. And when I was sitting down here tonight, excuse me, I'm fussing, there we go. When I was sitting down here tonight, I realized what I didn't think of at the time was I'm really grateful for having had like the reason why I got to be here every week for 25 years. Or 20, or I don't know how many it is now. It's almost 25, I think. Yeah, 25 years. So anyway, it is a big deal, I guess. We're spending our whole evening on this. There's lots of other things we could have done with this evening. But who would have thought that if you just show up every evening for 25 years, next thing you know, you're guiding this huge retreat, you know? It's kind of strange, but beautiful. Strange, but beautiful. They all experienced, and then most of them hadn't been in silence that long, like ever in their whole lives, you know? So they found that interesting. One other thing before I read this poem is one of the other things I love about the way we lead our retreats there is although all that we're in silence and we're trying to give each other complete space to have our own experiences, but we're doing it together, right? So it's sort of like silent together. But when we are moving around the campground, the grounds, during the breaks, you know, when we're more on our own doing individual practice, if we pass each other, we stop, and without looking at each other, we stop and we, you know, bow to each other. And so we didn't have anything like that either. So I thought, oh, that's another problem. I don't know how to solve that. We don't want to make them bow to each other. Probably someone would want their money back. But then my teaching colleague, a dear psychologist friend, mindfulness teacher friend from Princeton, I remembered a wonderful practice which we could all practice, which is when you see somebody, anybody, in the store, a friend, anybody, you can do what Sharon Salzberg calls stealth metta. Stealth metta. So metta means loving kindness, and stealth, like, you know, trying to get that back from the military. So you just look at somebody without them knowing you're doing it. You say, may you be happy. You know, may you be safe. May you be peaceful and joyous, you know. So then one of the participants who was the most upset about no eye contact and just kind of creeping her out, you know, she's just like, you know, I'm a nice person and something's not right here. But then once she had that, she was completely happy. Mm-hmm. Solved the whole thing. Yeah, she could just go around and and silently to herself, nobody knew, right? Maybe they knew. Maybe they could feel something. May you be happy. So here's the poem we read in the evenings. It's from the Irish poet John O'Donohue. It's called Binacht. I'm guessing that's pronunciation, which is Gaelic for blessing. So you can imagine 50 people reading this together in unison after all day of practice. On the day when the weight deadens on your shoulders and you stumble, may the clay dance to balance you. And when your eyes freeze behind the gray window and the ghost of loss gets into you, may a flock of colors, indigo, red, green, and azure blue, come to awaken in you a meadow of delight. When the canvas frays in the curragh of thought and a stain of ocean blackens beneath you, may there come across the water a path of yellow moonlight to bring you safely home. May the nourishment of the earth be yours. May the clarity of light be yours. May the fluency of the ocean be yours. May the protection of the ancestors be yours. And so may a slow wind work these words of love around you, an invisible cloak to mind your life. So anyway, takes a few repetitions. Takes like a week, you know, to get that down. And we did eventually. I was worried when we first did it, like, oh, this is too hard, you know, it doesn't scan very simply, you know. Should have done Michael Row Your Boat Ashore or something, you know. That was my earlier thought, but then I thought, no. Might have been beautiful, or people might have started throwing up or something, I don't know. Anyway, so I thought you'd like to hear a little bit about that. It was wonderful, actually. I really was pleased. You know what else I thought about that is, we have trouble really noticing what's happening. You know what I mean? Like, we have a limited range of what we think is happening. And when something really difficult happens, this is what it's like for me. When something really difficult happens to you, do you find it takes you a few days to kind of process that and kind of figure it out? And what was that? It was weird. And what did I do wrong? Or what did they do? You know, it kind of takes us a while to kind of get it sort of sorted out in our mind or get it to fit what we think is supposed to happen or something. I don't know. So what I noticed is this retreat was so wonderful and went so well that it took me a few days to process how good it was, you know. You know, so that's nice. Huh? So really good things happen, and that's also like beyond what we can sort of get, you know. So we're a little narrow, which is kind of in a way my topic for tonight. Oops. That's the wrong talk, excuse me. One moment. I was about to read you the talks I gave them, which wouldn't have been as relevant. We actually did daily talks about a Buddhist text, too, so the theme of it was the roots, the Buddhist roots of the mindfulness movement. So I'm not giving up on Buddhism, I'm just kind of sticking it in there, even though we're not bowing. Well, anyway, I've been really continuing to think, so we have this theme this season about tolerance and intolerance and love and trying to sort of study the most crazy political season ever as a topic, you know, a topic that we can learn something from and understand something from. And I know Andrea gave a talk last week. I haven't heard it yet, but I'm sure it was kind of continuing this theme in some way of how do we sort of create a world with our minds, you know, and how do we, from this created world, find ways to include each other and a way that's loving, a way that's inclusive, a way that's, you know, a way that's wholesome, you know, a way that's good. And I've been thinking about how this very same human mind You know, it can create hatred, can create divisiveness, and that it can also create love and inclusion. And sometimes we, I think, too narrowly believe that some people are one way and some people are the other way. You know, they're loving people and hating people. Viz Hillary's very unfortunate comment, right, about deplorables. But I think if we look at our mind for more than 5 minutes, you know, and meditation helps so much here, we realize it's not so simple. That there's no sort of fixed loving or fixed hating person in there. And when we were studying a little earlier in the fall, the wonderful teachings from the Yogacara Buddhist school that was reminding us that we all have within us these sort of stored up energies, what they call in that system the storehouse consciousness, which they say is full of seeds of everything that could ever happen for us. So seeds that could sprout and become hatred, seeds that could germinate and become love, seeds that could manifest clarity, and seeds that could manifest confusion, seeds that could manifest blue eyes, you know, just everything. Everything is in there. But that these seeds only manifest, only sort of result in something if the conditions are right. So it's not to say that some people don't, you know, maybe exhibit more loving behaviors and some exhibit more difficult behaviors. But this system suggests that, that may have more to do with the conditions and less to do with anything intrinsic in them. That somebody who thinks they're loving may have the seeds of hatred, and someone who thinks nothing but hate may have the seeds of love. In fact, probably they do. And it's interesting, you know, that when conditions are right, these seeds manifest, this system suggests, and we should study this for ourselves in meditation and daily life. How does it work for you? But when these conditions are in the right sort of configuration, there's the right triggers or the right environment or both, then suddenly there's something in the mind. There's an impulse, there's a feeling, there's a way of looking at somebody, there's a perception, there's a kind of leaning or, you know, sort of desire or a something sort of rising up out of who knows where in the darkness and being carried into our conscious mind. And it's carried there, it seems, by something that has a lot of sort of me to it. Like, this is me thinking this. This is me feeling this. This is me seeing this person. Somehow the me sort of gets carried right into it too. And then pretty soon we totally know what's going on. I feel this way. I feel that way. I know who I am. I know who she is. I know what you're going to say. Right? If you watch the debates, I guess you might be true about that. That it all kind of just happens so quickly, right? And before we know it, we're saying or doing or acting in some way, just like on autopilot, you know what I mean? Just, poof, you know, out it comes. Or, you know, also, it's not all negative, right? Also wholesome things. Suddenly we surprise ourselves with a moment of grace and patience, loving connection with another. I had a moment like that actually on Tuesday. I'm doing, just for a couple of weeks, a simple little mindfulness class at the Willows retirement home. And there's a group of 10 participants, and the median age is about 80. And the senior student is 95. And she's also a published poet. She gave me a book of her poems. And we had a lovely class. I felt very close to them, very connected with them. And then I saw Dorothy, is her name, the 95-year-old poet. I saw her in the lobby at the end, and I just had to go over and give her a hug. And we hadn't really had a hugging relationship. I was just like, Dorothy, oh. And she said, oh, a hug. It was so sweet. But it was also kind of impulsive, you know what I mean? I didn't really plan to do that. So some seeds manifested, and thankfully she wasn't offended or anything. I thought it was nice. So it's not all negative things, right? Or positive things, or negative or positive things. But it seems to just kind of overcome us, right? These impulses, thoughts, patterns, projections. And we're so sure that we're right about all of it, you know, and that's the other quality it seems to have. I know who you are. I know what kind of person. So it happens before we know it. And especially when we're busy and stressed out and rushing, before we know it, we're in some particular mindset. But we can know it. We can know it. We can notice more clearly these processes unfolding inside us. And we can bring our true values into play much earlier. We can notice a feeling of aversion, for instance, to another person. And what is it triggered by? What are the conditions? You know, it's interesting to see if we can notice. We can't always even notice what are the conditions that trigger or nurture the seed of aversion. It can be the trivialest thing, you know, most trivial thing, right? It could be like what kind of hair style they have, right? Or the way they walk, or their accent, or the color of their skin, or some little aspect of the shape of their face. It's amazing how exquisitely attuned we are to the shapes of faces. I was enjoying a moment with Alborz's now one-year-old son, Ezra, yesterday. Alborz's father, Riaz, these are our landlords and friends here in the building. And Alborz, the father of the child, is Iranian-American, and the mother is Korean-American. And so it's a little, beautiful little white baby, but there's just this little slant in the cheeks. You're like, oh, Korean. It just like popped out of me. Like, it's a Korean baby. Doesn't look like a Korean baby. It is a Korean baby. So, you know, conditions were right. Just a little kind of shape in the cheek. Yeah, Nick, now I'm going to mess you up if you ever hang out with this baby. I'm sorry, but. So just see him as a beautiful little baby. You know, just see a little Korean in there. Wonderful to be Korean. Quarter Korean, I guess, you know. I don't know. But actually, we can slow all this down. We can notice these emergences, these arisings. And then we can sometimes notice that first impulse, that little trigger, that leaning in or pushing away, that creepy feeling in the gut that could so quickly justify itself with a story and a theory that we were so clear on. So in this case of aversion to somebody, even a little baby, I mean, it's sad, isn't it, you know? I mean, it was a wonderful encounter with baby Ezra, but I had this little flash moment of aversion. You know, there it was, you know? So I had to be honest with myself. Am I a racist? You know, that seems a little heavy. Am I not a racist? That seems a little dubious, right? You know? You know? Lovely little baby. So how do we do this, though? How do we increase our chances of being a little more self-aware so that when that aversion arises, we don't have to go to that story? We can just note it, notice it. Ah, little nugget of aversion. There it is, you know. Unpleasant to be sure, but we do not need to hook it on to a manifesto, you know, or a political movement. It's just a moment of aversion. We can breathe in, feeling aversion is arising. We can breathe out, letting some of it go, letting it dissipate, and take a fresh look. Oh, right, I'm looking at a human being, or a tree, or a car, or whatever it is I'm looking at, whatever it is I'm perceiving. But this is not so easy to do, and so I was remembering about a wonderful teaching of Buddha that you know, I've studied before, and you've probably studied before, but I thought we'd bring it up again, that provides a powerful basis, really powerful basis, for this knowing, this kind of delaminating, this looking into these processes of mind and heart that can lead us down paths of joy and paths of, you know, populist nationalism, you know, and awful effect. So what popped into my mind was the teaching of the four foundations of mindfulness, the teaching of the four foundations of mindfulness, as a way to practice sort of attuning ourselves, opening up our inner antennae, getting interested in a grounded way in these processes of mind, and feeling, what happens for us. So I thought I would just begin this little series of talks tonight on the Sutra of the Four, on the Sutra of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Sutra on that, that we just will roll through tonight. And Saturday, did you know there's a wonderful little retreat here on Saturday? I believe there's still room. The registrar and the retreat manager are really tolerant people when the conditions are right.
Eno says, sign up now.
Yeah, so tonight would be good. We're going to have a wonderful little Sangha quiet celebration from 10 till 3. And then at 3 o'clock, we're going to have a ceremony of receiving the precepts, which is like one of our big ceremonies. It's a little bit... When I was in Africa and they were asking me, like, in Buddhism, what's it like? Do you go on Saturday or Sunday? And are there baptisms? And I said, yeah, we have baptisms. So it's the baptism, except we do it as adults. Anyway, so I'll give a talk that day. So we'll barely start tonight because I just did all this preamble. So we'll just kind of open up the sutra a little bit and then we'll dig into it with some space on Saturday. And then on the next several Wednesdays, we'll have more talks on the Mindfulness Sutra. And more importantly, I hope we'll, if it interests you, I hope you'll take it up in your daily life. I'll try to suggest a few ways that we could study it and practice these teachings every day. So for the main text, and you, there's no reason you have to get the book unless you, you know, have read all the books that you have on yourselves already. Wouldn't that be great? That'd be like finishing all your lists, you know. Anyway, but if you can't avoid getting a new book, this is a classic book from Thich Nhat Hanh on the sutra. They titled it Transformation and Healing. So this is what it looks like. There might be different editions. They change the covers periodically to keep selling books. But I'm appreciating Thich Nhat Hanh more and more lately. Some of his stuff at first glance seems pretty simple, you know, simple and sweet and very nice, and it is. But he has a deep understanding of all this material, so. And especially it's neat to study Thich Nhat Hanh, who is, you know, more or less a Mahayana sage, looking into early Buddhist texts. So we get the sort of benefits of both of those two broad swaths of Buddhism. The clarity and the step-by-step nature of the early Buddhist material, and the depth and universality and feeling for the emptiness and completeness of all this from Mahayana Buddhism. So first the title of the sutra in the Pali language, which is a language of South India that became the canonical language of early Buddhism. It was not, in fact, the language Buddha taught. Buddha didn't speak this language, so if somebody tells you that, they're kind of simplifying. So the title they gave it is Satipatthana. Sati is the word that gets translated as mindfulness, which, of course, is a big movement, and it's how I make my living, so I'm interested in that word. The original word meant something like to remember, to recollect, to bear in mind. And it was used in the pre-Buddhist Vedic tradition to signify remembering the sacred texts. So it already had a religious kind of cast to it. And so, you know, some English scholar had to figure out what English word to apply to that. There's not exactly an English word for that. So they chose the word mindfulness, bearing something in mind, holding something in mind. Which is pretty good, pretty close. And sati is also a mental factor and part of a complex sort of system in Buddhist psychology of looking at how consciousness works. It's primarily the quality of mind that helps you bring your attention back to what you're intending to hold your attention on. And then it cooperates with other factors, concentration, attention, understanding, and so on. So this has to do with mindfulness. It has to do with remembering something deep that we maybe forget, that we need to remember and to come back to. So it's remembering, it's coming back. The second part, satipatthana, turns out there's two different ways that you can make sense of that term. And one way is it means a place or a presence or an arousing. So it's like a place where you can practice mindfulness, a sort of arousing of mindfulness, a sort of area or focus for mindfulness. And I suppose these two meanings are pretty close. And the other meaning is setting forth or putting something forward, like a starting point or an origin. So like a beginning point, like I'm trying to do mindfulness, this would be a good place to start. So sort of a place to start or a place to be in mindfulness. And it's translated in different ways when the sutra is translated. Sometimes it's translated as four. And you notice the word four is not in the Pali at all. That gets added in English. Because there's four of them. But sometimes it gets translated as the four establishments of mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness, sometimes the four roots of mindfulness. Tinahan chose establishments. So there's going to be four major topics that we're going to look at with mindfulness. So let's set the scene and read the first section. This is a very famous early Buddhist teaching. I heard these words of the Buddha one time when he was living in Kamasamadhamma, a market town of the Kuru people. The Buddha addressed the bhikkhus, saying, "O bhikkhus," and bhikkhus is a Pali term for monastics, so "O monastics." And the bhikkhus replied, "Venerable Lord," so they're listening. The Buddha said, "Bhikkhus, there is a most wonderful way to help living beings realize purification, overcome directly grief and sorrow and pain and anxiety. It helps them to travel the right path and realize nirvana. This way is the four establishments of mindfulness." So there's an interesting term buried in there. So here's one of the problems and challenges and joys of this material, is it's all been translated multiple times. And here the root text that's being translated is in that Pali language, but then there also, it was not originally written in Pali probably, and it was written originally just recited orally. And there were also versions of this written in Sanskrit, which have largely been lost. And there are translations of the Sanskrit material in Chinese that are all a little bit different, use a little bit different words. And since we're trying to sort of understand the inner workings of our minds and hearts, the Buddhists, you know, invented words and used common words in particular ways. And so every time it gets translated, the translators have to figure out, you know, what are they really trying to say? What's the essence of what they're trying to say? And the section in here, the very enthusiastic section where the Buddha says, "Bhikkhus, there is a most wonderful way," turns out to be Tidnanhan's translation of a Pali term, ekayana magga. Magga is path, so he didn't use the word path. And ekayana, which he translated as most wonderful, actually doesn't mean most wonderful. Turns out it means one directional, one way. So that's a kind of interesting. So the suggestion is if you practice in this way, you won't revert. You won't go back. You'll make progress that's irreversible. So that's interesting. So this is a big statement. So the Buddha's saying here, whichever way we slice the language, that these teachings are a big deal. And it's going to really help us. So then he asks a rhetorical question. What are these four establishments? Four foundations. He answers his own question. Oops. First one. Bhikkhus. A practitioner remains established on the observation of the body in the body. Diligent, with clear understanding, mindful, having abandoned every craving and every distaste for this life. So that's the first one. So there's a formula here that's going to be repeated. Two, it remains established in the observation of the feelings in the feelings, diligent, with clear understanding, mindful, having abandoned every craving and every distaste for this life. Three, he remains established in the observation of the mind, in the mind, diligent, with clear understanding, mindful, having abandoned every craving and every distaste for this life. Four, he remains established in the observation of the objects of mind, in the objects of mind, diligent, with clear understanding, mindful, having abandoned every craving and every distaste for this life. So you notice like every word but one in those four paragraphs was repeated, which is common in these texts. So we have to kind of just merge with a certain style of speaking and listening. And this material, it's hard. You can't just read it or listen to it like a storybook or a novel, you know. It's just a different kind of writing and speaking and listening. So the three foundations of mindfulness are the body, first one. Next, feelings. The feelings is kind of a root feeling of feelings, not like emotion so much. The feeling, you know, the feeling of a moment, the deep feeling. Body, feelings. Then the mind, the thoughts and emotions, the objects that arise in the mind, which we get so entranced by, spend 99% of our lives in, right? And people sit down to meditate for the first time and they're maybe a little horrified, you know? And then they say to you a letter, oh, I can't meditate. I learned that tonight. I can't meditate. I could not quiet my mind. And you say, oh, sorry to tell you. This is not about that. And then the fourth is the most difficult to translate. Thich Nhat Hanh translates the fourth foundation, which in the original is dharmas. He translated that as observation of the objects of mind. I prefer patterns of mind, or just patterns, the big patterns of our lives. So that's the beginning of the text, and he's going to go on to give us some practices, and it'll be really interesting to slowly unpack that repeated formula. There seems to be, he's saying, there's a particular way to do this, a particular way to be mindful and curious about the body, about these kind of basis of feeling, about the objects in the mind, about the big patterns in mind. It sounds like a little bit of work. It's a diligent, mindful, and that there may be some conditions that facilitate that. The line at the end about working with our desires and our aversions, our cravings, which, as we were saying a little bit earlier, are part of what blind us to the sprouting seeds that lead to racism, because our mind is often a little bit destabilized by wanting one thing or wanting another thing. Thich Nhat Hanh wrote it as that you should have abandoned craving and distaste in this life. Abandoned craving and distaste, which is itself the whole thing, right? So anyway, we'll see how that goes and whether it's helpful. And helpful to many thousands of people over centuries, so one hopes it will be helpful to us. You never know. So that's enough for tonight. Let's enjoy the closing chant in the book, and then we'll stand up and bow and do the Tisarana, the refuge chant in the Pali language, the same language this text was written in, which I was trying to reference with a poem in my non-religious mindfulness retreat. I learned that I can't say secular retreat, which is really inconvenient because it's such a useful word. But it turns out to any committed Christian, secular basically means really bad, like devilish, you know, like the opposite of Christian. So I had to abandon secular. So now I'm universal.